From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we look beyond the grim fallout from the coronavirus pandemic at the acts of kindness inspired by the situation. I reached out to dozens of people making a difference in these early weeks of isolation for a cover story filled with good deeds and love. Today I'll be joined by Katrina Strickland, the editor of Good Weekend, and Tom Cowie, a reporter at The Age, to discuss this surge in positivity and connection. But first, actor Nick English will read the story in full. So make the most of social distancing and have a listen to For Goodness Sake.
It's the end of the last Sunday in March, and after dipping low in the vanilla autumn sky, the sun throws all its light on McFarlane Street. A yellow glow kisses this little road in Brunswick, in Melbourne's inner north. It dances on the puddles left by an afternoon storm, catches the buzzing mozzies, hits old chimneys and iron-laced balustrades and aluminium roofs, and one musical instrument. The latter is an antique cello, made in 1830 of flamed maple and spruce by a master craftsman from London. And it is embraced by its owner, Josephine Vaines, who sits on a chair between two paperbark trees, near her parsley patch and her passion fruit creeper and her yellow recycling bin, on the footpath in front of her cream brick home. Vaines, 45, is a chamber musician who has played with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra and taught at the Victorian College of the Arts. She's performed in European cathedrals of Gothic splendour, architectural recital centres in the US, the ancient Longyu Caves in China, the bottom of a mine shaft in Macedon in Victoria's Goldfields region. "Thank you for coming," she says to her neighbours, around three dozen of whom have, on cue, left self-isolation to come together, while remaining many, many metres apart, for a little concert born on a local WhatsApp group. "I hope you enjoy the show." They do. They might not recognise the last names of the long-dead composers on the set list, but they recognise beauty in suburbia. As Vaines plays Gabrielli, a happy couple sitting on folding chairs with teardrop wine glasses and a bottle of Margaret River Cabernet Sauvignon, rise to applaud. As she plays Sansons, a nuclear family crammed inside their blue Land Rover Discovery are rapturous. As she plays the famous prelude from Cello Suite No. 1 by Johann Sebastian Bach and The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel, others clap and grin from their verandas and driveways, leaning against a front gate or listening through an open bedroom window. "Beautiful," yells one man from a distance. "Thank you," waves another. "Thanks, Josie," says her next-door neighbour. "That was the first time I've heard you," says a bloke from around the corner, an interloper from Osborne Street, two blocks down. "And I cried. It was really beautiful." Vaines smiles. All the paid performances on her calendar are cancelled due to COVID-19, but this makes that more bearable. She plays a show at sunset every few days since the last week of March, a handful of songs for this street and for herself. "This is my way of feeling like I'm just continuing to do what I always do," she says afterwards. "I feel quite high now. It's a natural high, and I think they feel that way too. We all need something to look forward to, something to do and hear, together. Do we ever?" It's surreal, this silent, sequestered life we're leading, this isolation in a coronaviral vacuum. It's so often quiet and largely numb, yet punctuated by unwelcome sensations, isn't it? You've probably felt one or two. The cold prickle of anxiety, the crack of social dislocation. For me, it's lethargy, sometimes as a sharp strain behind my eyes, but more often like a thick blanket. Every little thing now feels effortful and earnest. Shopping runs are missions, during which we stand on crosses of electrical tape, listening to our own trepidatious gulps. Once outside, we can breathe again, but heave the odd sad sigh too, as we wander past shuttered shops. For the most part, we've all retreated behind closed doors into a kind of collective, solitary darkness. Yet it is in this darkness that acts of kindness and compassion and levity and connection, like a concert cellist playing with a view of a street gutter, stand out best. Some gestures flicker in our eyes like birthday candles. Others light up the night like benevolent flares. Everyone has a favourite pandemic pick-me-up. Perhaps you were touched by that coordinated minute of mass applause throughout the UK as people stood clapping for the exhausted carers within their National Health Service. Or maybe you love the daily appointment Italians have kept, playing music together at dusk, singing Volare from a balcony, or trumpeting on a street corner. For me, it's the smaller things, for they are legion and just as lovely. A basket of groceries left on a doorstep, a handwritten letter to an old friend, rural neighbours gathering at a safe distance for a chinwag and a beer over the back fence, a gift, a surprise, an approach, please made, heard, answered. They're all so tiny and bright. They're spreading, too, each warm act sparking a glow in another, like a chain of globes, blinking on and lighting up, one by one. Blink, still here. Blink, still smiling. Blink, still love you. When the shutdown began, Christina Melrose was having a shit afternoon. She's the regional general manager of a residential disability support service and doing a PhD in psychology and raising three kids, so is naturally horrifically disorganised. I had a fairly intense day at work with communicable disease planning and was just feeling a bit flat, Melrose 35 tells me, via phone, because that's the only wise way to interview people right now. I was definitely due for a bit of a pick-me-up. Instead, she pulled into her greengrocer, Gippsland Fresh Wholesale in Warragul, east of Melbourne, and her day got worse. She saw a woman in a tiz, frantic. She couldn't find food for her dog on the denuded shelves and was close to tears. Melrose couldn't help, so she trudged away, shoulders slumped, and began loading the car. Hard day. Then, there in her boot, she noticed her stash of Who Gives a Crap toilet paper. Melrose has been a subscriber to the charitable service for a while, so she won't face any shortage. On a whim, she snatched up the pack and skipped through the car park. She left rolls on roofs and bonnets and side mirrors. She moved with stealth, but one lady spotted her and instantly started crying. Weeping, in fact. The woman had Crohn's disease, an inflammatory bowel condition, and had been down to her last roll. Melrose fetched her another. Then, another woman, witnessing this, handed over the roll Melrose had left for her. This poor woman, now with three rolls, grabbed me and gave me a big hug, which you can't exactly say no to, says Melrose. She was sobbing, and I was sobbing. The interaction buoyed her. She told two mates about it online that night. Then the alerts began to pop up. Melrose had been tagged. A few of the recipients of her kindness had not needed her TP and apparently paid her rolls forward. One was handed to an expectant mother, another to an elderly man on a mobility scooter. It was amazing how this one spontaneous decision went on to have an impact on all these other people I'm never likely to meet, Melrose says. I never imagined that toilet paper could be a mechanism for division or unity. It's that old adage, if you've got more than you need, you build a longer table, not a higher fence. What's extraordinary about a story like this one is that, in this moment we're facing, this pause in our lives, such stories have become ordinary. Dr. Catherine Barrett was at home in St. Kilda on March 14, alone except for her schnauzer, Agnes. This was in the early days of panic buying, and the La Trobe University researcher and elderly advocacy expert was watching the news. Supermarket workers were breaking up brawls, sporting scratches and bruises. I've had depression and anxiety in the past, and I know enough about my mental health to know that in situations like this, I have to be proactive, says Barrett. For me, it's eating good food and exercising, but also finding something psychologically to grab hold of. Kindness seemed to calm my anxiety. I found myself listening to the health reports and government advice each day, but then switching off and focusing on stories of love and hope and people doing beautiful, constructive things. It became a salve. It was good for her, so it had to be good for others. So she sat down at her little desk in her two-room studio and created a Facebook page called The Kindness Pandemic, an online repository for all things joyous. Barrett got a few dozen followers quickly enough, then a few hundred, a few thousand. Within a few days, 60,000. Within a week, 250,000. At the time of writing, the group has more than 500,000 members. The page is a vertiginous, giddy spool of good deeds and encouragement. There are long testimonials, videos, and cute photos, but Barrett's favourites are the simple ones, like this. I bought a caramel twirl at a supermarket, and I gave it to a staff member, and she cried. You've spent $2.50, and you've transformed that person's experience and reality, Barrett says. And I just thought, this can be so simple. Everybody can do this. And people are. Within 30 seconds online, I find myself clicking through the Kindness Pandemic to Love Your Neighbour, to Preston Good Karma Network, to Viral Kindness Northern Beaches Sydney, to Frankston Community Notice Board. And that's just on Facebook. In the current crisis, a community network like Nextdoor, a hyperlocal app which helps users reach out to those who live nearby, has come into its own. Victoria Vassallo, 22, joined last year to stay in touch with other South Yarra residents about local break-ins. As the pandemic took hold, the fifth-year Monash University arts and law student thought of another use, offering spare boxes of tampons and pads to women running low. She wrote a post, not expecting to hear much. Then came the urgent replies. Do you have any super period pads available? And OMG, so need some. The next day, taking a break from the books, equity law specifically, Vassallo took a short walk to leave a box of pads for a woman recovering at home after surgery. We're in such a weird time, with so much negativity and hurt and people losing their jobs. We just need to look around to see if we can help, she says. Give away something you don't need. It's our duty as citizens. Adam Lust couldn't agree more. He usually spends Monday through Sunday in a Lexus SUV, ferrying people throughout Melbourne for Niceride, his premium carriage service. The novel coronavirus has crippled his small business. Lust has barely had a paid job since mid-March, yet this was the message he sent to his regular clients. If anyone you know, particularly the elderly or unwell, needs anything picked up or delivered from a chemist or a supermarket or a post office or anywhere else, we are happy to volunteer our help in any way we can. Soon enough, he was in his suit for his first free delivery, groceries and snacks for the families of the tiny patients at Monash Children's Hospital. A few days later, some of that kindness came flowing back when a client booked a midnight run, then paid Lust double the fare. It might just help me cover my rent this week, he says. This is the power of relationships. This is humanity. He's not the only one using a dormant vehicle well. DJ Nigel Beck, 63, usually spins tunes in Deirdre, his green 1970 Volkswagen Combi. But every booking has vanished, from the Collingwood Football Club season launch to his own daughter's wedding. So, DJ Nige just drives around Gippsland now, stopping in country towns to play What the World Needs Now is Love and other tunes. His roadshow might take in Mowi, Morwell, Mafra, who knows. I'll just go where the mood takes me, Nige says. I get such a beautiful reaction, kids busting a few moves, a few people crying. In an otherwise ageist world, the elderly are being treated as they should. Most supermarket chains in Australia swiftly launched dedicated shopping hours to give the vulnerable a chance to gather supplies before the shelves are stripped bare each day. But the practice actually began at a little IGA in suburban Melbourne's Altona with owner Hitesh Poulter. Poulter had seen the footage of clamouring masses and lines for hand sanitizer, and he knew he had to act. I never thought our society would do something like this that would hurt our elderly, he said. We need to stick together at this time. We all need to help one another through this. That's precisely what Sumit Malhotra was thinking when he began offering free daily takeaway meals to senior citizens at the 6 Angan Indian restaurants he owns throughout Victoria. Malhotra, who grew up in Jaipur, had witnessed his sales fall from the usual level by 25% 1 week, 40% the next, 70% the week after. But he wasn't thinking of that when he saw a disorientated old lady outside her grocer. She had wanted meat, but couldn't find any. No pasta either. She was spinning, panicked and afraid. I said, "My restaurant is next door. Why don't you come next door and I'll cook you something?" She had a lamb curry and tried to give me money. I said no, and tomorrow, if there is a problem again, you come straight here. When people are pressing the panic button, we need to do something to help people feel calm and secure. These acts of kindness, they are like a virus too. People see them, and there is this human tendency to follow good things. This is correct. We are wired this way. What's interesting about kindness is we do it for the benefit of others, but it also gives the giver a little booster shot. All of that benefits the group too. So it's not just win-win, it's actually a win-win-win situation. That's Professor Leah Waters, founder of the Centre for Positive Psychology at Melbourne University. Waters researches and teaches the science of happiness, at least when she isn't holed up at home in the eastern suburb of Blackburn with two teenagers. Waters says, evolutionary psychologists have long found evidence of the social glue that holds us together, kindness, compassion, empathy, altruism, throughout history, across all cultures. The obvious emotional benefits are not intangible either. There's extensive research into what happens when someone laughs with you, and how that changes your physiology, and how your brain gets a little shot of oxytocin, which makes you feel bonded, and which lowers your cortisol level, which relieves stress, which increases our ability to function well, Waters says. Intimacy has this biological effect, allowing the individual and the group to soothe itself. Before people began printing pro forma notes to leave in letterboxes, offering to help their neighbours in need, a wonderful idea, the author Anna Crine was already leaving handwritten cards for the older people in her Williamstown neighbourhood. She posted one note online with an offer to drop off food or wine or magazines or books, even precious toilet roll. It was decorated with a crayon drawing of a shark by one of her young sons. It just seemed like a normal and natural thing to do, she tells me, to let people know we're here, we're thinking of them, we have legs and youth, we can scout for them. Dr. Raj, a few doors down, was desperate for porridge, so she found him some oats. We'll have some more orders coming in soon. People are getting nervous. We may live to regret it. Crine laughs with a hint of fatalism, and we talk about the implicit reward in offering to help someone out. In a sense, there's a degree of selfishness to it, she says. Nietzsche talks about how charity is more about making the giver feel good than actually doing something helpful. She may be referring to his book on the genealogy of morals, in which the philosopher suggests giving and helping are petty pleasures and refers to good deeds as the happiness of slight superiority. Maybe it was just a thing that made us feel good, Crine muses. So far, even though we're all obsessed with coronavirus, things have been easy, but we don't know how it's going to go. Come the depression, I'd like to think I'll be one of those people who take others in for a meal. I hope I would be. I wonder if she thinks we'll be changed by this in a positive way. Will we take succor from the altruism around us and carry that into whatever our next reality holds? Crine pauses. Probably not, she says. We might have this brief scare, try to get our priorities straight, but fear and trauma can do ugly things too. I worry that the kindnesses we have witnessed so far which seem so overwhelming in number and nature, only seem that way because we're looking for them, because we crave them. Ever since the rise of the alt-right, Trumpism, Brexit chaos, Me Too and the climate catastrophe, we have sought snug little stories of safety and comfort. Media organisations globally now curate heartwarming tales into landing pages and content streams. The Sydney Morning Herald and The Age recently added sections to their websites called, simply, Good News, where readers can devour stories about pandemic pen pals, suburban teddy bear hunts, or self-isolated opera singers performing I Still Call Australia Home from a unit balcony in Sydney's Waterloo. Maybe we're witnessing all this positivity now, because it's all we can bear to see. I'm also struck by how many of those doing good deeds tend to already be carers. At random, I find 5 touching stories of empathy online. From a lady distributing care packages to the disabled, to a woman purchasing pet food en masse for an animal shelter, and contact them. And those 5 people are, in order, a community healthcare worker from Melbourne's Coburg, a road trauma recovery specialist from Sydney's Vaucluse, an adult intensive care unit nurse from Brisbane, the convener of an online support group for Pakistani mums, and a primary school integration aide. So, have we really been changed by this harsh moment? Or are we just finally noticing the do-gooders in our midst? I would like to think, at least, that the inventive acts of human connection we're witnessing are something fresh. We're certainly coming up with new expressions, like caremongering or being groupish instead of selfish, for behaviours born largely online. Something does seem to have shifted in the digital realm. Look no further than writer and refugee advocate Nadine Cohen, whose Twitter identity, all of her posts are written in capital letters and start with the words, F yeah, is a mixture of hilarious righteous outrage and raw compassion. A recent post offered a shout-out to a lovely worker at Baker's Delight in Bondi Junction, who, at closing time, offered her a free bag of bread rolls. Then, once she learnt she was about to visit Somalian refugees self-isolating in Marylands, gave her 7 bags instead. "It was really nice of her," says Cohen. "There's been so much attention paid to the hoarding and fights in supermarkets, but I've seen a lot of warmth, both offline and online." Cohen was once a creative strategist for Google, and has found Twitter in particular to be a newly positive space, notwithstanding misinformation about bogus coronavirus cures or ineffective recipes for homemade hand sanitizer, or racist attacks on Asian Australians. The goodwill has been overwhelming. "We've gotten more donations than we can fit in my car. We've been humbled by kindness more than wounded by nastiness." Social media, formerly a place of wasted hours, cyberbullying and narcissism, appears to have morphed into a force for good. Even the celebrity posturing feels more real than affectation. It's actually quite nice to watch Keith Urban singing on Instagram, thanking healthcare workers and first responders, while our Nicole dances in the foreground like a barefoot goofball. It's cute listening to J-Lo and A-Rod do the couples challenge, answering stupid, funny questions about their life together in isolation, however gilded and privileged that existence might be. And it's downright beautiful to hear Patrick Stewart reading Shakespearean sonnets, because such posts are now something more than light entertainment. They're moments of connection. Hand in hand with this renewed intimacy online has come the decline in IRL, in real life, obligations. No more work dinners or cocktail functions or coffee meetings, any meetings really, nor any school fetes or parent-teacher interviews. The pandemic thus becomes a moment to reset, and a chance to ask the question, was that really how I wanted my life to be? In the blurb for her book, Happy Never After, Why the Happiness Fairy Tale is Driving Us Mad and How I Flipped the Script, writer Jill Stark asks, what would happen if we stopped chasing, stayed still, found calm and meaning in places we least expected? I wonder if 2020 is our chance to answer that question. I think 21st century living, for many of us, has felt like we're pounding a treadmill and going nowhere. It's fast-paced, relentless, endless, and in an age in which we're so connected online, we're still profoundly disconnected from each other and from our own wants and needs, Stark tells me from her desk. She talks about our uniquely modern malaise, the cult of busyness, and how racing towards burnout has become a competitive sport. For many people, this will be the first time they have to be still, says Stark, who is also a consultant for Beyond Blue. For the Sunshine Singers, a mixed seniors choir who meet for 2 hours every Monday morning and have done for a decade, what matters most is music and one another. The group, run by Waverley Council in Sydney's East, has been tested more than most this past month. It is usually 36 strong at Bondi Pavilion, but herding them together online for their first ever gathering by video conference was a challenge. They can be a bit technophobic, laughs Cassie Bartolomei, 55, the freelance singer and teacher who leads them. When the soft shutdown began, I was worried. A lot of them are truly stuck at home, and a lot of them live alone. The choir is their weekly chance to venture outside, from their apartments and aged care facilities in Honebush, Concord, Bronte. They usually start with scales and rounds and learn a new song before recapping old ones. This time, Bartolomei didn't teach them anything new. They belted out You're the Voice by John Farnham. They crooned Young at Heart by Frank Sinatra. The song they did last was Close to You by the Carpenters. Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. It's challenging. The platform means they can't all hear one another, so they aren't getting the raised endorphins they usually do when their voices unite. There are lags and connectivity issues. It's messy. But they can see everyone. Their mouths moving, says Bartolomei. It was so much better than nothing. They all felt happier just for having a sing. One woman is on a post-cancer drug program with a repressed immune system. I'm so alone and lonely, she said. This has just lifted my day. Another woman said her smile was back. My body is tingling. I'm getting emotional. Sing on, Sunshine Singers. Bartolomei was, in truth, thrilled before they even began. When they first appeared on her computer display, she'd sent them links and download instructions, but still wondered how they would cope. I was terrified, she laughs. I thought I was going to sit here alone with people not knowing what button to press. She needn't have fretted. One member is in her 90s, and there she was, her little face in a square on the screen on Monday morning, Bartolomei says. And then all these other little beautiful faces starting appearing. Bing, 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 bing. They were just so divine. They're all looking forward to next Monday morning too, when they get to sing together again, see their friends again, when their faces will pop into the frame again, one after another, and another, coronavirus be damned. Bing, still here. Bing, still together. Bing, still singing.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland and I'm the editor of Good Weekend. Joining me today for a discussion about kindness are Conrad Marshall, senior writer with Good Weekend, and Tom Cowie, reporter with The Age. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
I think we'll just get straight down to the point. Are we really being kinder or are we just noticing it more because we need a little more positive news? Let's start with you, Conrad. What's your sense on that?
I think we are being kinder. I think it's coming through, really shining through online, of all places. There are so many stories just emerging and it's really easy to kind of scoop them up as a reporter. You find one Facebook group and it leads to another Facebook group, to another Facebook group. You can find various hashtags on Twitter. Instagram is always the more positive of the three, but even it seems to have gone to another level.
The fascinating thing about this whole moment is that we really are all experiencing the same thing at the same time. So we kind of know, you know, everyone's got varying degrees of problems, but we know what each other's going through. So there's this sort of empathy that's really shining through, and you're seeing it absolutely, like Conrad said, come through on places like Facebook and Instagram, where people are sharing these amazing moments.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of your piece, Conrad, was you quoted the journalist Anna Krein talking about how easy, in a sense, it is to be kind at the moment because there's not a lot to lose. You know, handing over a packet of toilet paper is not that, you know, you probably can buy some more, but that, you know, the rubber will really hit the road when things are, if we do go into a kind of depression type of situation, when there's a lot to lose and when giving something to someone else costs you a lot more. Talk us through that, because I think that's really an interesting point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think right now we seem to be experiencing kind of discombobulation, confusion, worry, but has genuine, for a lot of us, has genuine fear set in? Have we all already lost our jobs, and are we, the people who have lost our jobs, giving up meals? Are we inviting other people into our homes? And what does it even look like, given that we're talking about a pandemic? Can we invite people into our homes? How are we gonna manage that kindness when things get really, really bad, if they do get really, really bad? And I'm not sure I know what the answer to that is. And Anna, to her credit, sort of said that she's not sure either. We can't just look on the bright side all the time, that things aren't so simple and can get quite ugly when real fear is involved. I think I'd also just say that this hunger, this sort of thirst that we have for stories of kindness can only be a help as things get worse. The very fact that there's this sort of demand for those kinds of pieces can act as sort of inspiration for us to act well in the future. And I mean, readers tell us all the time that they want more positive stories, they want less grim news. And apparently, you know, in the offices of The Age, that only ramped up, you know, even more so once COVID hit, because that's what people want. Like, they simultaneously want to dive in and know every gory detail, and they want to jump on their phone immediately when they get up and see what's happened overseas overnight. But at the same time, they want to be kind of comforted, I guess, by these sorts of stories.
Social media turnaround has been phenomenal, hasn't it? I mean, now that we can't see each other, it's really come into its own as a force for good. Whereas I think before this, so many of the stories and conversations that we were all having were about what bad it was doing for society and how much more isolating it was for people and how, you know, all the downside of it.
Yeah, well, there's an observation in Conrad's piece, I think it was Professor Leah Waters who said that kindness isn't just beneficial to someone else, it's beneficial to you. These acts of kindness happening between, you know, one person and another, but also everyone else is able to witness it because of social media, because things can go viral, and because everyone has a phone, everyone can post about it. And maybe that will change the way we respond, because we can see these things happening and get them reinforced, these acts of kindness. There was a real movement around screen time and cutting down use of your phones. And I think my screen time is up.
Yeah.
You know, double at the moment. I'm on my phone all the time. Yeah, we are now connected through these apps that before people were trying to detox from. You know, you kind of have to rely on them a little bit.
Yeah, I completely agree. So when I was putting it together and looking at some of the fun things that celebrities were doing on Instagram, I did not expect to enjoy them. I did not expect to enjoy Keith Urban playing the banjo in his little studio in Nashville with our Nicole. I definitely did not expect to enjoy J-Lo and A-Rod doing the couples challenge. But I think, and I'm trying to figure out why I did enjoy them so much, and I think it's because I know that they're going through what I'm going through in some way. We are all connected by this, and we've never been through anything in our lives where we're all connected by it.
There's also the potential for it to go very wrong, and we've seen some of that as well, where maybe celebrities miss the note or
Give us a good example of that, Tom.
There was the Imagine clip. I'm not sure if you saw that one.
Oh, yeah.
People singing John Lennon's Imagine. That
so
didn't
why
go so
not?
Well.
What was wrong? Let's analyse that. What didn't work about that one?
Celebrities are going through the same thing we are, in a way, but they're also not, because they're insanely privileged and they have lots of money and they're not, you know, in any chance of really losing the way that other people are, and they'll have access to the best healthcare and that kind of thing. So you got to get the tone right, and if it doesn't quite, if you don't nail it, you are in real trouble. And the way that social media moves at lightning speed at the moment, you know, you could be very quickly cancelled, as they say, or ratioed.
And I think in that example, it felt a little bit more produced, because you're like, look, it's just dozens of these celebs, so they're this very tight circle. And on top of that, it was much earlier in the piece. I mean, I've lost all concept of like day and night or what month are we in right now, but it felt like that happened much earlier in the piece, before things even got incredibly serious and scary in America. So maybe it felt like they were jumping the gun to be invoking Imagine at that point in time.
Gosh, and I guess it just shows, doesn't it? You've just got to do what feels authentic, and it'll play how it'll play. But as long as you've done it in an authentic way, you just have to live with whether the world hates it or loves it. And how are you finding actually working from home? Somehow it's more exhausting doing the same number of hours because you're on your own. Are you finding that?
I certainly am. My writing tends to rely on sort of colour and dynamism and observing people in the moment and getting access to them in the places where they work and play, and having to gather all of that over the phone or on sort of shoddy Zoom connections with lags and delays is a bit of a nightmare. But I don't know, it also means you have to sort of hone another tool in your journalism kit bag, I guess. I will say that the one moment that I went and observed personally for the story in Good Weekend about kindness was lovely, and I jumped at the chance for it. It was a woman playing cello for her street in Brunswick, these tiny little impromptu concerts where everybody gathers on their own veranda or in their car or at their front gate, so they're suitably distanced. And I drove 90 minutes on a Sunday night just because I needed the opportunity to go out and do something and see something new. I think it's going to be really challenging for reporters at our mastheads, and Tom reporting on a much broader range of things, I'm sure, would have greater challenges than me. How's it been for you, Tom?
It has been really difficult. And I did like that about your piece, Conrad, on McFarlane Street. You could tell you really relished that. Like, there's so much detail in that scene, and clearly you enjoyed, you know, doing that, writing that part of it. I do a little bit of general news reporting for The Age, and the main issue is access, a bit like you, Conrad, in that we just can't go up and talk to people on the street. We can't go to their houses. We can't go to their places of work. So we're relying on people to pick up the phone. We're relying on them to respond to emails. But there was an interesting piece written by Zach Barron at Esquire, who profiles people like Brad Pitt, about the challenges of writing profiles at this time, because all the best stuff happens when you're with someone.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I'm profiling Taylor Harris right now for the magazine, the AFLW star. And one thing I have found across all stories is that because people aren't available in person anymore, they're super available online. Like, I've Zoom chatted with her 4 times already, but finding those details, I'm finding it's more about recreating anecdotes, which means a lot of questions about when did that happen? Where were you sitting? What were you wearing? And, you know, again, it's fun. It's just another tool in the journalism kit bag that you have to hone. And so who knows, maybe we'll all emerge from this as better reporters.
Yeah, absolutely. I did find that with our piece on kindness, when I contacted lots of people, which was typically online through Facebook Messenger, that kind of thing, people were very quick to get back to me, and that's not my usual experience. And also, people were very keen to be involved. Our story was essentially a collection of about 19 or 20 different tales of kindness, and that didn't take long at all to collect. Normally, if you had to get that many stories for one piece, it would take a long time. But this was a matter of days in people getting back to me and saying, yes, I'd love to do that. I can see why it's important. So that has been a welcome change, I will say, in this current world.
Can we just finish off with a quick question to each of you? What are you loving and hating most about this time?
I am really loving the chance to get my bread skills up. Apart from that, there's not a lot that I'm really enjoying about it. It's every day is so long, and it feels like we're all counting down these months, but we don't know when those months will end. But there are some good things. I will say the thing that I'm missing the most is going to the gym, things like that. That kept me pretty sane before, and I'm missing out there.
I'm definitely loving the daily walks with my son, playing games with him, seeing my wife a lot. And then hating, I think it's got to be the people that are in isolation. So poor old mum, 77 years old, rattling around in a house by herself. And I hate that idea. And I'm trying to come up with new ways to sort of connect with her. And then there's just that overarching existential fear of, when will this all end? And can I get my footy back soon, please?
Yeah. The thing that I'm loving is having a clear diary at this point. My job was a lot of meetings and a lot of after work events or dinners or those kind of things, and I think most people in that kind of a role are secretly loving the fact that they don't have to go out after work or go to a whole lot of meetings and then do their real work after hours.
You've left out the one really big positive though, Katrina. I've seen you posting about it and messaging about it. These are these meals that you make every few nights that you get sent from a particular restaurant in Sydney.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I've been trying to partake in the restaurants that are doing take home now rather than dine in. And I just think if you are employed, it's a really good way to ensure that your favourite restaurants stay afloat. So we've got one favourite down the road called the Fish Butchery, and we decided we're going to have fish from there every week. Then another place with pasta. We are cooking ourselves as well, I mind you, and they're doing amazing jobs. I mean, talk about the overused word pivot. They really are. It all comes packaged up and a little salad with balsamic on the side. I mean, it's fantastic. So that is good.
I'll say I'm enjoying that as well. I really am. I think the idea of people reaching out and trying to support their local restaurants and cafes is a really nice part of this. And as you said, they're all really looking for creative ways to stay open. And I've got a little list of all my local places that I used to go to that I'm, looking up what they're doing online and trying to order something, every once a week or couple of weeks or whatever. And yeah, I think that's a nice thing to do as well.
Yep. Well, on that note, I might go and get a coffee from my favourite cafe. Thanks, guys, and keep being kind.
Stay safe. Wash your hands.
Thank you. See ya.
Good Weekend Talks is brought to you by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance from Conrad Marshall and technical assistance from Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.